of the Reformation and church history. We are up to week 5. The handouts are on the back. So one of the problems we have with going through the Reformation very, very quickly like this, going through it in 7 weeks, is that we don't really have time to go through a deep dive into the things that we've covered, but we have to move at a fairly fast pace. We also have to select which parts of the Reformation we want to cover, because we've got a lot of it. It covers a lot of Europe, and so the focus for these 7 weeks has been in a straight line towards where we are. It's how we got to the system of theology we hold. So that means I have to cut out some of the more interesting parts. And I was reminded of that as I was preparing this lesson for this week, because we've gone through the proto-reformers. We went through Peter Waldo and Wycliffe and Jan Hus. We talked about the Lutherans and the Anabaptists. We talked about Zwingli and Calvin. That was last week. Well, as we're looking at the magisterial Reformation, that is, reformations involving church governments, We see Luther was supported by the German princes. We see Calvin was supported, at least in part, by the City Council of Geneva. We see also the opposition. The Calvinists chased out of Paris by order of the king. The king is Catholic. The Inquisition is in full force in France, as it is in Spain. And so you see kings refusing to support the Reformation. You see democratically elected councils supporting the Reformation, and it would be nice to show a king that supports the Reformation in a good way, and for that I would love to have time to go into Sweden and talk about Gustavus Adolphus, but we don't have time for that, and he's not in direct line with us anyway, so it's a very big tangent to go that way. So we get Henry VIII. So as we look at the English Reformation, we get into a very bloody time of church history. This is going to there are a lot of people who die on both sides. Henry VIII is equal opportunity in his tyranny. Catholics and Protestants both die in large numbers during his reign. As we're looking at this, we're getting into the subject of martyrdom. And in the we keep coming back to the early church fathers. One of my favorites, Tertullian, famously said in his defense, in his Apologeticus, we multiply when you reap us. The blood of Christians is seed. Tertullian was a student of Cyprian. Cyprian went through what is considered by John Fox to be the 7th general persecution in the Roman Empire. Tertullian was a student of Cyprian who then became a lawyer and defended Christians in the Roman court system against the persecution. And so in his defense of Christians, he saw that the persecution of Christians, while it was a bad thing and it was a horrible thing, it also leads to the growth of the church. John Fox, who is contemporary with the time we are going to be talking about this morning, takes that concept and he writes a book, Fox's Book of Martyrs. And as you get to the time contemporary with John Fox, he talks about three men in particular, known as the Oxford Martyrs, Thomas Cranmer, Hugh Latimer, and Nicholas Ridley. And so while we can look at the magisterial reforms, we can look at King Henry VIII, there's not a lot there that we can say is good. But when we look at where the Reformation actually comes to England, we can look more at figures like Cranmer, Latimer, and Ridley. So that's where we're going to put our focus. And so that's where we start off today with Thomas Cranmer. Now, Thomas Cranmer is kind of the reluctant reformer. He was a good Catholic. He was raised as a good Catholic. He went to Jesus College in Cambridge, starting at the age of 14, 2 years after his father's death. He studied there, was a good student, achieved his Master of the Arts in 1515, was ordained in 1520, and pursued his Doctor of Divinity and achieved that in 1526. He was a very good student, studied Erasmus, studied Luther, and absolutely hated him. Really good Catholic. He writes in his margins about everything. He preaches very strongly against Luther. He preaches very strongly against Erasmus's critiques of the church. And is very devoted to Roman Catholicism, and is content to just be an academic. He is a fellow at the college. He gets his fellowship, and I should have mentioned, between his ordination and his Doctor of Divinity in 1526, he actually gets married. So he's ordained, he gets married. England has a law again of clerical celibacy. Clerics are not supposed to get married, so the college removes him from the fellowship. His wife dies in childbirth, and they reinstate him to the fellowship, and that's when he achieves his Doctor of Divinity. And so you see that while he is against Luther, he still supports some of Luther's ideas, like the idea that priests should be married. So anyway, his rise to power came not through any design of his own. Like I said, he's very reluctant to actually seek power for himself or to achieve anything. He's content to just kind of toe the line and be agreeable with everyone. Well, the king, Henry VIII, has become very displeased with the circumstances of his marriage. Catherine of Aragon Let's back up a little bit and give a little bit of context. So the noble house of Tudor started with Henry VII. Henry VII, he ended the War of the Roses, marrying into the opposite house, and so was able to forge a peace at the end of the War of the Roses. He had his oldest son born in Winchester, which was the legendary birthplace of Arthur, and also named his son Arthur, hoping that his son would be the beginning of this grand and glorious British kingdom. Arthur, he then decides, needs to have a strong alliance, and so he marries his son Arthur to Catherine of Aragon. Then Arthur dies. And so then he has to come up with a new plan. He decides that the old plan was fine. He just needs to switch sons. So he decides to negotiate for Catherine of Aragon to marry his son Henry, which was discussed at the time as perhaps not being a legal marriage for various reasons based on Levitical law. But they were able to go through with it, and everything was going fine. But over the course of their marriage, Henry VIII was unable to have a son to take over to serve as his heir. He had a short-lived son that lived 2 months, but then died in infancy. He, with Catherine Aragon, also had a daughter, Mary, who will become very important near the end of this particular chapter. And through all of this, Henry starts to really revisit Leviticus and the Levitical prohibitions on marrying your brother's wife and things of that nature. And so he starts deciding that maybe we've got a court case so I can divorce her and marry this other young lady that I would rather be married to. And now it just so happened that there was a very opportunistic cardinal named Thomas Wolsey. Now Thomas Wolsey was very eager to gain power and to gain favor, and he actually had a title of being the other king, the Alter Rex is what they called him, the other king, that he had been serving as regent before Henry VIII took the throne. He was still holding on to power. He was kind of the shadow government behind the king. He was trying to run things, and he decided, you know what, we can get you a divorce. We can make this work, and we can curtail the powers of the Pope at the same time in England. And so Wolsey starts manipulating things and starts trying to figure out how to get this divorce to go forward. And in doing this, he decides, you know what, we need some fresh minds in this. And so he goes, he's heard of this smart doctor at Jesus College named Thomas Cranmer, and he brings Thomas Cranmer in to start helping with these proceedings. He also knows Cranmer is a loyalist. He is fiercely loyal. He always toes the mark. He's always loyal. He never says anything disloyal to the king or to the church, so he's going to be a great choice. And then Cranmer, in a dinner, then suggests that why are we asking the Pope? Why don't we just poll all the colleges around Europe, see what they say, and if we have enough support from all the universities, then we can make a stronger case and we can get this thing done. Wolsey liked this idea. He took it directly to Henry. Henry loved this idea. And so then they have to start sending dignitaries out to the various kingdoms to get this, dig up support from the rest of the kingdom. So Cranmer is then sent to Cranmer is then sent to the court of Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor. Holy Roman Empire, you always have to say this. It was neither holy, nor was it Roman, nor was it imperial. But he went to the court of the Holy Roman Emperor. He was supported in England by Edward Fox, who was the Bishop of Hereford. And they would go on to do a number of great things together. While he was also in England in this political mess, he got to meet with Thomas More, also heard, he was the Lord Chancellor, he heard what Cranmer's solution was. And at first, More is willing to go along with Cranmer's suggestion. He likes Cranmer's suggestion because he can't imagine that any of the universities in Europe, giving this careful consideration, would ever side with Henry. Thomas More is a very good Catholic. He is supporting the Pope, and he is supporting Catherine of Aragon in this. He believes that the divorce should not take place. It is not a biblical grounds for divorce, and so he opposes it. He's also in opposition to Luther and to but at the same time, he's also a very good friend of Erasmus. Thomas More is also a good friend of William Tyndale, who is at this point also translating the Bible and then gets martyred by Henry VIII as well. So, like I said, Henry VIII, equal opportunity. He kills William Tyndale for translating the Bible into English. He then eventually executes Thomas More because he is not a loyalist. I mean, he goes through three different trials where he's exonerated before he's finally able to get him executed. Now, Thomas More is executed due to Wolsey's plan to push for the supremacy of the king. So Wolsey, his whole model here is that the king should be the head of the church, not the pope. Wolsey starts pushing for this and starts pushing a bill for the supremacy of the king. And everyone is supposed to sign it, but Thomas More, who is the Lord Chamberlain, Lord Chancellor, who has already gone through three trials trying to get him removed from office, refuses to sign it. He's the only only person in the government who refuses to sign it and refuses to go along with King Henry VIII on this. And it is on this point that they're able to finally convict him of treason and have him beheaded. Just before he was sent to the court of Charles V, as they're making these plans, he also meets with Simon Grynaeus. Now, Simon Grynaeus was sent by the Lutherans to come and talk to England. Since you're talking about breaking with the Pope, why don't we talk about joining the Lutheran Church? Why don't we talk about reforming the Church of England like the Church of Germany is being reformed? Simon Grynaeus presents a number of the problems that they have with the way the church is being run, and they come up with the 10 articles with Edward Fox and Thomas Cranmer and Simon Grynaeus, and they come up with the 10 reasons, the 10 things they have against the church, and these three submit their initial 10 articles. Henry VIII then heavily modifies them. So the 10 articles, the first five cover the matters of faith, that is the Bible and the ecumenical creeds, baptism, penance, Eucharist, and justification. The last five are on matters of worship. So you have images, veneration of saints, prayers to saints, rites and ceremonies, and prayers for the dead. These 10 then sort of form the basis for what the Reformed Church is going to be in Henry's day, but Henry is still very much devoted to Catholicism, except for the Pope. He doesn't like the Pope, but he's fine with the rest of it. It doesn't bother him that much. So Henry VIII isn't strongly committed to this, and so a lot of this is hindered. So then This much having been done, the Lutherans are dismissed. Cranmer is dismissed back to down to Germany to the court of the Holy Roman Emperor, where he meets with Andreas Osiander, another reformer. And it's here that he starts to really take on some reformed ideologies. He starts to become reformed himself. He doesn't have so much of a major conversion like John Calvin had, but he does start to shift into reformed ideologies under the tutelage of Andreas Osiander. He stays with him for a while and eventually decides to marry his niece, Marguerite Prue. Once again, he's ordained. He's under legal obligation to hold to clerical celibacy. So this is him breaking the law and also committing himself to the Reformed faith in at least that much. He did live openly with her as his wife in England up until the latter part of the reign of Henry VIII, when things started getting cracked, when she had to actually go to Austria to get out of England. But then she came back after that in the time of Edward VI. But as he's in the court of Charles V, he's trying his best to get the emperor to sign off on this. The emperor is not interested in breaking with the Pope. He's not interested in Henry VIII getting a divorce. He has no interest in making the Spanish angry with him either. So Charles V isn't interested in the envoy that is being in his mission that he's been sent to perform. But he receives a letter while he's there. Now, remember, to this point, he has been a scholar, and he loved being a scholar. He liked doing that. He's met some big names in the British government, but he really isn't a high member of any political office. He isn't a major influence on the church at this point. He's just a guy. I mean, he's just a professor at a university. He suddenly gets this letter out of the blue saying, "You're Archbishop of Canterbury, come back to England." Complete surprise. He did not know that was coming. But what had happened, the original Walford, I think was his name, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had been semi-loyal to Henry VIII, had died, and Henry VIII thought this was a great chance to put somebody who was a complete loyalist, whose loyalty he could not doubt at all, into the position as Archbishop of Canterbury. And who better than the highly educated Thomas Thomas Cranmer. Everybody's named Thomas in this. I just have to remember that that's not a typo. So Thomas Cranmer, taken by surprise, guess what? You're now Archbishop of Canterbury, and now he's got to come back to England and fill that role. One of the first things he has to do is oversee the court case of John Firth. Now, John Firth is a reformer, though he does reject infant baptism, and he rejects a couple of other things, starts going into kind of an anarchist mode. And so he's seditious against the government and is a problem, but he's being tried as a heretic, and Cranmer is having to preside over this case while at the same time mostly agreeing with him. And so John Firth is convicted of heresy in the court of the Anglican Church and is executed by being burned at the stake, which had something of an effect on Cranmer at this time, because he starts to realize that while he is archbishop, he has no power. He realizes that there is a very strong conservative faction within the church that has no respect for his authority and believes that he is just a puppet of the king and that he should not be archbishop. And so he starts trying to do his job as archbishop and overseeing the Church of England and trying to enact reforms, but he finds himself at every turn hindered by a king who has no interest in reformation and by a conservative church who holds strictly to Roman Catholicism and also has no interest in changing. So he uses what little influence he has to ordain men that he can trust, that he believes would lead the church in the direction it needs to go. And one of those is a very brilliant man named Hugh Latimer. Hugh Latimer, born in 1487, ordained in 1515, a very solid education, very strong humanist education. For the first 7 years after he's ordained, he preaches very hotly against Luther and Erasmus. Latimer is another one of these guys that toes the mark. He preaches Roman Catholicism and preaches against the Reformation. But it is, at least according to John Fox, at an establishment known as the White Horse Tavern, that he is able to meet with others who share the Reformed faith. And it is at the White Horse Tavern that Lutheran ideals and Reformed ideals start entering into the conversation with the clergy in England. That's in Cambridge. And so Cambridge, the White Horse Tavern, becomes a major center for Reformed ideas, and Hugh Latimer is converted to the Reformation and to the Reformed theology. Being a preacher of the Reformation in England, he is then noticed by Cranmer, who then promotes him to Bishop of Worcester in 1535. And I know I'm pronouncing that wrong because I've watched a bunch of British documentaries on some of the secondary figures of this, and that's not how they pronounced it. So I'm going to continue to pronounce it Worcester, but I know that's not how the British pronounce it. He was Bishop of Worcester until 1539, at which point the six articles are published to replace the 10 articles. We'll get to that in a second as to what those were. But he opposes those, and Henry VIII gets mad and removes him from office as a bishop and throws him into the London Tower. He spends a lot of time in the London Tower. He clear up until, I think, the reign of Edward VI. But he also, while he was in the London Tower, is able to then find members of the royal household where he can serve as their chaplain. So there's kind of a weird thing where he's not toeing the mark. He's not agreeing to the king's decrees on what the church is supposed to believe, but he's also acting as a chaplain to members of the royal family during this time. He continues to preach. He continues to find opportunities to write and to work the Reformation from prison and from house arrest, and continues that work of Reformation. And Hugh Latimer, even though he no longer serves as bishop from this point on, is still remembered as the Bishop Latimer and is still remembered as a major force of the Reformation for decades to come after this. So he becomes kind of a living martyr, as it were, suffering for the sake of the Reformation, and he is a center point for the Reformation growing in England. During this time, Wolsey finally makes a couple of missteps. Thomas Wolsey tries to gain a little too much power for himself in this power struggle with Henry VIII, and Henry VIII has him removed, and he puts a new man, Thomas Cromwell, in place in those positions of power, and names him the vicegerent. So basically, he is second only to the king, and this promotes him even above Thomas Cranmer. So Cranmer now has a boss, Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell is reformed, or at least semi-reformed. He's sympathetic to the Reformation, but he's also a corrupt politician who is willing to do whatever he can for a buck. So Cromwell starts taking a lot of steps to ensure that the Reformation keeps happening. He keeps pushing for reformed bishops. He's helping Cranmer. He's aiding and abetting Cranmer in replacing bishops with reformed bishops and with spreading of reformed theology throughout England. Something I forgot to put in the notes, so I missed it. I forgot to mention it at all, was that Cranmer was also supported in a lot of this by the Boleyn family. He had a lot of financial and political support from the Boleyns, and during this time, Henry has been married to Anne Boleyn, but with Wolsey gone and Cromwell coming in, he is able to, with Anne Boleyn having not produced a male heir, and having had three miscarriages, he decides she has to go. He accuses her of infidelity and has her executed. And it's important to note that Cranmer didn't know about this until after the trial. Once she was imprisoned, he starts pleading her case, saying he thought the charges were trumped up, that she was not guilty of these things, and he is one of the only public figures in England to have mourned her death. But after this, he marries Jane Seymour, who finally gives him a son, Edward. Thomas Cromwell doesn't like Jane Seymour and ultimately moves that Henry marry Anne of Cleves after the death of Jane Seymour. Henry VIII isn't interested in Anne of Cleves. He doesn't want to marry this woman, but he takes Cromwell's advice and he marries her anyway, and of course that ends in disaster, and just leads into the next two marriages, so the six marriages of Henry VIII. But in his divorce with Anne of Cleves, he also decides to fire Cromwell. Cromwell loses his political power at that time. But in losing Cromwell, Cranmer no longer has that shield and protector above him, being that buffer zone between him and Henry. So at this point, Cranmer finds himself unprotected, he finds himself unsupported, and he finds Henry VIII hostile to the Reformation because Thomas Cromwell had defended it and promoted it so much. So in being hostile to that to the Reformation, he starts to undo it. He receives a a number of emissaries from the Lutheran princes. Philip Melanchthon sends him a letter, says, here are some things we have against what you're doing in England. We think you ought to change these things. Melanchthon had heard that Henry VIII respected him. You remember when we were talking about Luther, Henry VIII had no respect for Luther. Luther had once addressed the letter saying that he was Martin Luther, pastor of Wittenberg by the grace of God to Henry VIII, King of England, to the disgrace of God. This made Henry VIII very angry, and he hated Martin Luther and wanted nothing to do with the man and swore that Lutheranism would never be a part of England. But then he started reading Philip Melanchthon. He liked Philip Melanchthon, so Philip Melanchthon tried to take advantage of that to critique what Henry VIII is doing in England. Henry VIII responded by saying, we are not doing any of that, and released the six articles. On transubstantiation, he argued that, no, the bread really does turn into the body of Christ. We aren't accepting your explanation for that. He rejected the ultraquists, that is the idea that the cup needs to be given to all members, to the laity, when you're serving the serving communion. It was the practice that only the priest took the cup during communion. And so the Lutherans are saying you need to give the cup to everybody. Henry says, nope, we're not doing that. Melanchthon says you need to stop taking vows of chastity. He says, nope, we're keeping that. You need to give up clerical celibacy. No, we're keeping that. Private masses, we're keeping that. And auricular confessions, that is confession to a priest, they were keeping that. And so Henry had no interest in getting rid of any of these things and made this the rule of the church. We are going to do these things. This is the way the church is going to be run. So Cranmer finds himself in hot water. He finds himself being the archbishop of a church he doesn't agree with, and immediately comes under attack from the Privy Council. The Privy Council starts trying to reject him, but Henry VIII realizes that Cranmer, while he may disagree with him theologically, Cranmer is fiercely loyal. He is the ultimate yes man, and he has to protect him because of that. And so he gives him his ring with a seal, and so as the Privy Council starts to investigate Cranmer, basically they try to arrest him, and he presents the king's seal to him. To them, and they realize, you know, we can't touch a man who's got the king's seal. What he's doing is done with the king's approval. We can't touch him. But the Privy Council tried really, really hard to have him removed, and he had four really rough years under Henry VIII and the Privy Council coming after him because he would not conform to the six articles. But Henry dies, and his son, Edward VI, comes to the throne in 1537. He is a boy. Cranmer gets to preach at his coronation, and he preaches in the sermon comparing him to Josiah, because Edward VI has been raised in the Reformed Church. He's taught Reformed theology. He knows the Bible. And so with Edward VI, he's able then to start enacting true reform in England. It's been a long time coming. It's been a hard road. And Cranmer was drug kicking and screaming the whole way. And so now he is finally in a position where he can actually do something. He finds a young man named Nicholas Ridley. I say young man, but you got to remember that Cranmer at this point is in, pushing 70. So Ridley, I think, is in his late 40s, early 50s. Nicholas Ridley, who is reformed, who had been a parish priest, he had been a chaplain. He had been elevated to Bishop of Rochester in 1547, as he gets to 1550, and Edward VI is now on the throne, he needs him in a more prominent position within the church, and so he moves him to London, and it is there that they can start really working reform in the Church of England in London. With Nicholas Ridley, with Hugh Latimer, they're able to start really preaching the gospel and teaching the Reformed faith, and they start realizing, you know, we still got this strong conservative faction outside of London, and so we need to deal with the conservative church. We've got all these churches doing different things and worshiping in different ways, so we need a way to unify the church. So with the help of Nicholas Ridley, possibly entirely from the pen of Nicholas Ridley, though it's hard to tell how much Cranmer wrote and how much Ridley wrote, they developed the Book of Common Prayer. This is the way in which the church is to pray. This is the way in which worship is to be directed, and it moves the church into a strongly reformed way of worshiping. And at the end of Edward's reign, in the last year of Edward's reign, he manages to finish writing the 42 articles, which serve as the basis of what is today the 39 articles in the Anglican Church. The Anglican Church today is governed by the 39 articles. It's a reformed creed, and it's good. We are not Anglican, so we don't use it, but it's fine as a reformed confession of faith. But the 42 articles serves as the basis for that, but it goes into effect at the last minute, just as Edward VI dies of tuberculosis. So really bad timing. Edward VI was 15 years old when he passed away and had no heir. And so he had no heir that was born of himself. But they were starting to realize, as he was getting sick, as he was not in good health, that they needed to create a will that would leave the kingdom in good hands should he pass away at a young age, which they saw coming. And they were looking at, according to the laws of succession, the next person to get the claim on the throne was Mary Tudor, born out of the marriage between Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. Now, Mary was a devout Catholic. She pretty much had to be because her mother was, her mother was Spanish. Her claim to the throne is that she was a legitimate daughter of Henry VIII, and that legitimacy is based entirely on that marriage still being legitimate. So the divorce, in order to be illegitimate, England had to be Catholic and reverse that position. So they knew that they didn't want to go back to Roman Catholicism, and so Edward VI, being the son of Henry VIII and Jane Seymour, decides to disinherit all of the other children of Henry VIII and declares that his cousin, the Lady Jane Grey, Henry VII's granddaughter, or great-granddaughter, Lady Jane Grey, to be his heir in the event of his death. The Lady Jane Grey in 1537 was very young. She was, I think, no, in 1553, she was very young. She was 17 years old when she took the throne in 1553. No, in 1554. So she's executed in 1554. 1553, she takes the throne at 17 years old. She reigns for 9 days. So She had been trained in the humanist colleges of England. She was raised in the Reformation. She was very strongly reformed. She was a very highly educated woman. Even she was very highly educated for that day, bar none. I mean, whether she was a woman or not, she was extremely well educated, but she also was very strongly supportive of the Reformation. But she was only 17 years old, and the Privy Council decided they were going to put her on the throne, and then halfway through the process decided they didn't want her on the throne and supported Mary instead, and so she was queen for a period of 9 days before Mary Tudor came into London and arrested everybody. So then began all the trials, the trials of the various political leaders. They go through. Mary Tudor becomes known as Bloody Mary because during her reign, lots of people die. She starts going through and punishing all those who were politically involved with having her mother, her mother's marriage annulled and removing her mother as Queen of England. Punishments all around, lots of people being beheaded and burned at the stake. She initially tries to leave the Lady Jane Grey in the Tower of London and doesn't want to kill her cousin in that way. But then as various nobles start trying to mount a coup in order to put the Lady Jane Grey back on the throne, she decides she has no choice. She has to execute her, so the Lady Jane Grey is executed in 1554. So after she had spent her time going through meticulously wiping out the political opposition, she then turns her attention to the religious opposition. Ridley, Latimer, and Cranmer were all arrested after she took the throne. Ridley was the youngest at the age of 55. Latimer and Cranmer were both older. I think Cranmer was in his late 60s and Latimer in his early 70s. And so these men were put on trial for the things that they had taught. They were asked, they were ordered to recant. Ridley and Latimer got to go first in the trial, and as they were going through their trial, they continued to defend everything they had taught. They defended every point of the Reformed faith that they had ever taught. Latimer, being as old as he was unable to stand up under debate. He couldn't stand at the podium and debate with anybody. He could not defend himself in person, and so he was allowed to give a written record for his position and to debate through writing rather than through oral argument. But both men were convicted. Both men were found to be guilty of promoting the Reformation in England and for promoting heresy. They were then, on October 16th in 1555, marched out into the square in Oxford to be burned at the stake, to which Nicholas Ridley said to and Hugh Latimer, they gave each other a hug, and Nicholas Ridley said, I pray to God that the flames will be merciful, or if not, that we will at least be able to stand up under their heat. To which Hugh Latimer responds, play the man, Master Ridley. We shall light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out. Hugh Latimer has a lot of good quotes. I mean, in his trial, he says, I thank God most heartily that he hath prolonged my life to this end, that I may, in this case, glorify God in this kind of death. That is, he's looking at the type of death he's about to die. He's looking at the charges that are being brought against him. He's looking at the witness that he has brought for Christ. He's not willing to recant. He is going to die in the death of the martyr. And he is glad that God has allowed him at this old age to continue in this. And even at this statement he makes to Ridley, it's a reference to an older martyrdom story, the story of Polycarp. And if you've read Fox's Book of Martyrs, Polycarp is one of the earlier martyrs in that book. And so it kind of begins with Polycarp and it ends with Ridley and Latimer. And you've got this bookend of this idea of playing the man as Polycarp is being burned at the stake, he hears a voice out of heaven saying, play the man, right? Be bold. And so You've got this idea of we're following in the footsteps of the saints that came before us. We are not doing something new. This is the way the church is treated. And this understanding, going back to Tertullian, that where the church is martyred, where the church is persecuted, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Thomas Cranmer, at the time, was brought up on the roof of the prison to watch the execution of Latimer and Ridley. Latimer passed pretty quickly from it, but unfortunately for Mr. Ridley, it was a very long and agonizing experience. His brother tried to speed up the process by throwing fuel on the fire, and it made matters worse. And he lamented that God wouldn't let him burn, and for just. But you've got this idea that he's. It was a very horrible experience that Thomas Cranmer gets to witness, and seeing how they're treated, seeing all this, Cranmer, always kind of being a little wishy-washy, decides he's going to recant. Under the tortures that he'd been enduring, under the torments of his friends, seeing what was going on, the horrible situation around him, he decides, you know what, I'll just say that the Pope is the head of the church, and that's fine. And so he signs the papers, he does everything he has to do. And Mary the First remembers that Thomas Cranmer was very instrumental in getting her mother divorced from Henry VIII. And she doesn't care if he's willing to accept the Pope as the head of the church. She wants him dead. And so he is set to be executed anyway, regardless of his recantations. He should have been, by the church's standards of the day, absolved of all sins and released. But Mary I wanted him dead, and so she sentences him to be burned at the stake. He is then to make public recantation before his execution, and he is allowed to preach a sermon and publicly recant. And he is brought to the chapel. He has written his sermon ahead of time. He has published it. He has given it to the papers to be published. And he stands up at the podium, and he starts his sermon. And he talks about how he has said many things that he regrets saying. He has said many things that were wrong, and he needs to recant of them. And he proceeds to recant of all of the previous recantations he had given. Says, I was wrong to say the Pope is the head of the church. He's the Antichrist, and his teachings are the teachings of the devil. He says that I, throughout my life, have taught the that salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone, and that is still what I believe. And he says, and so I'm telling the truth now, and it says, and this hand is the hand that I recanted with, and that will burn first. And so as he walks out to the fire, he sticks his hand in the fire first so that he can, just as a symbol of his recantation of his recantation. So he makes this very bold statement at the end. So Thomas Cranmer, he has this kind of wishy-washy, yes man tone to his life, but at the end, he ends faithfully preaching probably his best sermon before he goes out to be burned at the stake. And so when we're looking at the Reformation in England, it's not a grand, glorious affair. It's a mess. It's a lot of people being people. And you see the politics getting involved in it, and the purity of the gospel kind of takes second seat to all of this. But in the end, you do have the gospel spreading. And so as we get to this part, I feel like this is a great time to end it, because from here, next week, we're going to go into John Knox and the Reformation in Scotland and what continues after this. So any thoughts, any questions? We've got 15 minutes. Yes. Yes, they did. Yeah, it's if you go to Oxford, there's actually a the old in the pavement in the square in Oxford. There's this little pothole where you can see the original pavement, and there's a cross marking where they were burned at the stake. So, yes. No, it was the government. He preached it to the government. It was definitely it was a trial. It was still part of his trial. Yeah, it wasn't to the public. Yes. Not publicly, no. And yeah, there were times where he asked Henry to reconsider. Made it very clear that he did not approve of what Henry was doing, but he did not condemn anything Henry did outright. Which is problematic. I mean, he's not like I said. He of the reformers, he doesn't really have a backbone. Yes. Yes, yeah. We could do that whole, I didn't want to read Fox's Book of Martyrs, but yeah, the whole thing about the death of Ridley and Latimer, I mean, the witness they bore. But they, once again, that harkens back to the whole thing of the martyrs of the ancient church singing while they were being executed, and that whole pattern is reenacted visibly by Ridley and Latimer, and I mean, unmistakably to those who were watching, that they would know that this is how the early church died, this is how these men are dying, and drawing that connection that this is the way the church is persecuted, and this is persecution of righteous men. So. Yeah. Well, yeah, Fox's Book of Martyrs is an interesting read. If you haven't read it, I definitely recommend it. Some of his historical facts border on the legendary rather than the historical, but it's a very good book. A bit gory in places, but any other thoughts or questions? Yes. After Mary, well, we'll get into that with Knox, but yeah, after Mary, so Mary spends several years as queen and is eventually replaced by Elizabeth I, and Elizabeth, in order to legitimize her position as queen, has to bring back the Reformation. She's not exactly keen on that idea, but in order to legitimize her position, she has to prove that the divorce between Catherine of Aragon and Henry VIII was legitimate, which means she has to be reformed. So she brings back the Book of Common Prayer. She brings back the 39 articles. Actually, she brings in the 39 articles based off the 42 articles of Cranmer. Elizabeth I is the one who really brings the Reformation back into England after Mary Tudor is finally removed from power. But yeah, we're going to get into that because Knox has several run-ins with Elizabeth during his time reforming Scotland. So Elizabeth I will play a huge role in that as well. Any other thoughts, questions? Yes.
Would people have been considered Puritans at this period, or would that have been sort of applied to a later?
I think to a degree, I think the roots of Puritanism are starting here. You do have those who want the church to go all in on the Reformation. But I think it's in the time of Elizabeth that where the church is finally reformed, where we're finally getting a solid reformed church, and everybody's going, yeah, but it's not reformed enough. You don't want to go all the way. And so the Puritans are trying to bring the Reformation in full force to England, whereas at this point they're just trying to get the Reformation into England. But I think you do have various elements that want it to come in full force and others that just want it to come in part way. Anything else? Well, then I think we will say that that is the Reformation in England, and we'll call it there for today. Thank you.